三月初唐苏起初南马江珠白绿到你家苏起大一金苏起皮苏南一罗拉边之三月初唐苏 I go for refuge until I am enlightened.To the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints, from the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened. To the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints, from the virtuous merits that I collect,By the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha, the benefit of all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this, an offering is a Buddha realm. May all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's benefits. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Saparivara Ratnamanda.Uza Mega Samudra Sapara Samaya. Okay, welcome. How's your cups? Clean and whole and
upright
and ready to be filled up. We'll find out. So, the pop quiz is, what was your homework?
When I got home, I couldn't remember the question.
Anybody remember the homework?
I think there was two, right?
There was only one, but if you get that one, you'll get full marks.
I thought there was two. It was like, look up the five sins that are like...
Yeah, the five heinous sins. And what was the second one?
The meditation.
Sorry?
Like the meditation.
Oh, well, that's, yeah, that's sort of...Standard, yeah. Yeah, so the five heinous crimes or the five, it has a bunch of different names. We ran into it on page 60, and there it's called the five limitless crimes. So it says it's also rare not to have committed heinous actions, which consists either of committing the five limitless crimes oneself.Asking others to do so, or rejoicing in the commission of these five limitless sins by others, which seems to be the most common of the three. That was the homework. What's the answer?
Okay, like they said, like killing the mother and the father, hurting the Buddha, and like hurting their body, the Buddha's.Body or hurting the Buddha in some way because you can't kill it, like you said.
Drawing blood or something.
Right, that's it. And then the other thing was separating the Buddhist community, which I thought was interesting.
Causing a schism in the Sangha.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Causing a schism.
There's one that I can't. Oh, hurting the guru or killing the guru, isn't that? There was one that I was like. Okay, sorry. Anyways, that's all I can remember.
Okay, so let's say them again. What are they? Killing. Your mother, killing your father,
drawing the Buddha's blood,
with the intent to harm, obviously, yes. And causing
schism,
as I say. And what's the fifth one?
I thought it was hurting the guru, but no.
Not believing in the guru?
Nobody consulted Buddha Google?
I did.
Yeah, killing an arhat.
Oh, a saint.
Now, what is it? What, maybe we should clarify this. So, first of all, you can't kill a Buddha. We went through that, right? Because they're not subject to death. But if you intend to, and there's a famous story of Buddha's cousin who tried to assassinate him. killing an arhat. Now, what's the difference between a Buddha and an arhat?
An arhat is not an enlightened being.
What are they then?
Well, they're beings
who are liberated.
They're liberated.
Liberated means what?
They have followed the Four Noble Truths teaching, and have, I guess, some are no returners or.
Yeah, what are they liberated from?
Suffering
from samsara, yeah. from the rebirth cycle of samsara. They're liberated from that, but that doesn't mean they're fully and completely enlightened like a Buddha. Mm-hmm. And so how does that come about, that you have these two different results?
It comes back to intention.
Okay.
Motivation
is everything.
Okay.
So an arhat, essentially, is motivated to be liberated for him or herself. A Buddha is motivated to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings.
Yeah, okay. Buddha gave lots of teachings because there's all different kinds of beings, all kinds of personalities and proclivities and propensities and tendencies and all that. Something for everybody. But in general, you could divide it into two different groups. The motivation to do it for myself. I'm suffering and I want to get the heck out of here. Or, yeah, but everybody else is too, so I'm going to do it for everybody else. So those are the two divisions. Mm-hmm. Lots of other divisions can be made. Sorry?
It has to be one or the other. It can't be both. Like, usually intention is...
That's a very good point. Actually, you can do both. So it's called the two benefits for self and others.
Geshe said there were five motivations for doing meditations.
Mm-hmm.
They got more progressively sophisticated spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do number one and then you do number two, well, you get number one's benefit by doing number two. Mm-hmm. And doing number three, you get the benefit of one and two and three. So doing the fifth one, which is the Buddha intention to benefit all living beings, you get all the benefits of the previous.
Well, he was sophisticated, and I'm really simple, so we only have two here.
Oh, well.
So if you do the benefit of all beings, well, I'm a being too. I get in that group.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good point, good question. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, the Dalai Lama says a truly selfish person is altruistic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so if you enter into the what I call the foundation path, or whatever you want to call it. There's some Sanskrit words, but they've kind of gone by the wayside. Where you're only doing the practices for yourself, it's still valid. It's still Buddha's teachings. You know, there's nothing to be criticized there. But the end result is arhatship. This is a simplified explanation of it. Okay, we could go on and on and on about this, but just to clarify what we're talking about here. And an arhat is subject to death. So if you kill an arhat, that's one of the five serious crimes. So that's a little distinction there between arhat and Buddha.
You'd have to know if someone is an arhat.
Well, just don't kill anybody.
Right, but still, you'd have to know that
you were an arhat. That's my... Yeah. Hopefully you won't get to that point. Okay, so I believe that we ended up on page 67, if you have a text. And where are we here? What are we doing? We're on the impure vision, right? And if we do the study of the impure vision, there's different sections, and we're in the precious human rebirth section still, mm-hmm. Right? What's the thing that we want to be developing in the precious human rebirth section? What are we looking to enhance?
Prerequisites?
It's a prerequisite, but we're looking, there's a quality that we want to be thinking about developing while we study this section. Before it was renunciation, mm-hmm. But now we've shifted into
diligence. Mm-hmm. Promote diligence, like time to roll up our sleeves and practice, yeah? Right. So precious human rebirth, we have this incredibly rare, rare opportunity. And we listed some of the components of that, and we're still going through that. So the prerequisites, the precious human rebirth prerequisites obtained will not last long. So we have this incredible situation where all these boxes got ticked and we've filled in the answers correctly and we got this precious human rebirth to be here. But it doesn't last that long. Relatively speaking, it's very short. Yeah. So that's the section that we're going to go into now, that the prerequisites obtained will not last long. So we start off right off the bat with a sutra. Would somebody like to read that for us? Anybody?
Okay, I'll do it. As it was said in E Sutra, monks, one who ponders on impermanence worships the enlightened ones. One who ponders on impermanence is prophesied by the enlightened ones. One who ponders on impermanence is blessed by the enlightened ones. Monks, the footprint of an elephant is the best among footprints. The perception of impermanence is the best among perceptions.
Okay, so this is the beginning of the emphasis on the importance of this topic of impermanence. It's said that a good Buddhist meditates on impermanence every day, or meditates on death every day. It's really fundamental, and it has so many benefits, as we're going to find out. And of course, these were written in the context that the audience, you know, is in India, and the reference to the elephant having the best among footprints is because the elephant leaves the biggest footprint in spite of being vegetarian. And that's a reference that people in India would know right away, but that's a kind of a little bit obscure, but we'll just fill that in for you. And so now we're going to reflect. Remember, listening, contemplating, meditating. So we're going to reflect on the benefits. So let's start off there. Would somebody like to read that?
Sure. The reflection on impermanence has inconceivable benefits. Reflection on impermanence is said to have an inconceivable benefits because it checks attachment for things. It is a goad that stimulates vigor. It is an antidote to suffering, and it is a helper in realizing emptiness, the ultimate truth. One, it checks the attachment for things. By meditating on impermanence, one realizes that one cannot have confidence in any external or internal phenomena, and one does not produce intense attachment for anything.
And I would add, for anyone. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's in there too. I'm going to read it here because there's a lot of stop signs in this next section. So the second one is, it is a goad that stimulates vigor. In the beginning, knowing that the time of death is uncertain causes one to enter religion. Or as we said, you could substitute spiritual path or dharma if you don't like that word religion. And then the second one is, in the middle, it acts as a condition which encourages one to practice religion. So we enter and then we practice. And finally, it assists in impressing upon one's mental continuity the real dharma. First of all, we have this phrase, mental continuity, which we hear expressions like this a lot. The mind is described as a continuum, as a stream. We have, you know, streams of thoughts and stream of consciousness. So this is an image that you see a lot. And then real dharma refers to something that has benefit in the next life. Geshe Thachi Nhamo used to say, next life is more important. Next life is more dangerous. So why do you think he would say something? First time I heard that, I went, well, that's kind of odd. Why would he say something like that?
It seems, and that could be an illusion, that you have more control of the next life right now.
Yeah. How do you control it?
By your actions.
Yeah.
Your merit, I guess.
And why is it more dangerous?
Because past karma can roll in the previous lives.
Yeah, and we don't know what that is. Unless you're totally omniscient. We don't really know. So now is the time to be contributing to your RRSP spiritual retirement plan, right? That's what real Dharma means in this particular section. If one does not understand impermanence, even if one dwells in formal religion, one is no different from a townsman who has donned a monk's yellow robes. Even though one vocally claims to be practicing religion, one's heart is seized by the desire for this life in cherishing gains, praise, food, and wealth. I remember lots of times somebody would say to Geshe-la, oh, she's a nun or he's a monk. And Geshe-la would say, well, how do you know? Just because you have on red robes? When I lived in Italy, there's a saying there in Italian, l'abito non fa monaco, which means clothes do not make the monastic, which is just their way of saying the same thing.
They don't make the person either.
Sorry?
They don't make the person either.
Yeah. Whatever one performs of listening, contemplation, and meditation, there's those three again, it is directed solely for the purpose of achieving greatness in this life. Now that sentence is a little bit unclear, I think, when I first read it. That doesn't mean that you should direct solely for this life. It means the opposite. So what they're saying there is somebody is not practicing correctly. They're performing it for the greatness of this life. Mm-hmm. So let's be clear about what that sentence means. Mm-hmm. If one understands impermanence, then, like prodding a fine horse that has been mounted, it causes the unreligious to enter the door of religion, the inferior religious practitioner to become mediocre, and the mediocre to become superior, and the superior to become very superior, and the very superior to attain Buddhahood. So you can place yourself where you want on that scale. And then number three, would somebody like to read number three for us?
Sure. It is an antidote to suffering. A person who has realized compounded things to be impermanent is not frightened by the agonies of death. So what to say of other trifle sufferings? Therefore, reflection on impermanence is the most excellent method for gaining liberation from suffering.
Yeah, and it removes the fear of death. The Dalai Lama says that a true Buddhist practitioner views death like one would view escaping from a burning house. Mm-hmm. It sounds kind of, to some people, it sounds kind of odd to be meditating about death every day. Come on. But it actually improves the quality of your life mm-hmm. if you do it. Okay. Four?
It is a helper in realizing emptiness, the ultimate truth. If phenomena were by nature truly existent, they would not be impermanent. However, since they undergo change and transformation due to various deeds, karma, and conditions, their nature does not exist in any way whatsoever. Thinking through in this way, one will gain realization into the ultimate truth. As it was said by Maitreya Ananta, the meaning of impermanence is emptiness, and it is characterized by origination and decay.
Okay, so this is just kind of hinting a little bit at the topic of emptiness, or ultimate truth, which we're not going to go into in great detail here, but it does list this as a benefit, especially in the beginning when you're, you know, entering that topic, which is really deep, to meditate on impermanence. It's the fundamental, it's starting point, so to speak. By the way, Maitreya Natha is just another word for our friend Maitreya. Okay, so how do we do that? How do we contemplate impermanence? Does somebody want to read that for us?
I will.
contemplate impermanence, one needs to, one, reflect on the certainty of death and thus relinquish grasping at permanence, two, reflect on the uncertainty of the time of death and thus shorten the range of one's plans, literally mental activities, and three, reflect that non-religious activities are not beneficial and thus practice the holy dharma.
Okay, so these three topics are classical Buddhist teachings that really go to the heart or the foundation of the teachings, of the certainty of death, the uncertainty of the time of death, and how at the time of death only spiritual practice is the only thing that benefits. So this is a really important section here. Go ahead, Laurel.
Okay, number one, reflect on the certainty of death and thus relinquish grasping at permanence. A, reflect that death is certain because having been born, one does not have the power to remain. B, reflect that death is certain because the body is insubstantial. And C, reflect that death is certain because life is not permanent. A, death is certain because having been born, one does not have the power to remain. One might think that based on this body endowed with the prerequisite, one must purely practice this holy religion, but that one has plenty of time to practice and can do it in a very leisurely manner. This is wrong, because one has to practice religion very diligently and starting right now. There is neither time for leisure nor time for practicing in a leisurely way, because it is certain that one must die. As it was said in the...
That's called Removing Sorrow by Ashvaghosha.
Like this, death dwells in front of all that is born. Have you ever seen, heard, or had any doubt that someone, whether born on earth or in heaven, who did not die? Who has ever seen or heard any credible report that someone, having been born in the world, is able to always stay on at will without dying? Thus, there is no grounds for doubt about the possibility of not dying, since death is definitely known to dwell in front of all living beings that have been born. Therefore, death will surely come. From the very moment of conception in the mother's womb, one goes on the path leading to death without being sidetracked even slightly. As was said in the...
I couldn't find an English translation of that.
Okay. From the night when they entered the womb, worldlings advance on death's path without detouring, swiftly going to the Lord of Death. To make us realize that having been born, one must surely die, even the noble ones who have discarded birth and death, which arise from karma and afflictions, pretend on having been born to pass upon beyond parinirvana. Then what to say of us who are totally bound by karma and afflictions?
Okay, so that word pretend, I think we might be able to substitute something like they manifest it. I'm not sure pretending is really gives the sense of it. They're not really pretending.
They're acting it out.
Yeah, they're showing it for our benefit. So Buddhas are not subject to birth and death, right? But the Buddha was born and the Buddha passed away. We don't say died, we say passed away or parinirvana. And there's the story or the description about that. So why would they do that? Why do you think the Buddha did that? If he didn't have to die, why did he bother?
To show the rest of us.
Show the rest of us what?
Impermanence of life.
Impermanence? Uh-huh. And?
No one is exempt.
I guess the preciousness of it, right?
Uh-huh.
For us.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But also that there's nothing to be afraid of.
Uh-huh. All those things. And also how to do it.
Yeah.
how did the Buddha actually die? What did he do?
He lay on his side.
Which side?
The right side.
On the right side. And then what did he do?
He put his head in his hand.
Okay, how did he do it? Just any old way?
No.
Or a particular way?
He had himself propped up a little. The head was propped up. Held by his elbow and the hand held in the head.
And why did he do that? Because he was used to watching TV anyway.
No?
Why did he do that?
Well, he knew where his exit was, for sure.
What do you mean, his exit? Yeah, without going into a lot of detail, there are energy channels in your body, and if you put your thumb right there, you block one of them. And also there's one on the right side of your body which has to do with the discursive thought process that we all have to the maximum, most of us. And if you squish it, you suppress that. You suppress the discursive monkey mind, and you get calm. Mm-hmm. When you're dying, do you want to be out of your mind crazy thinking thoughts, or do you want to be calm? You want to be calm. So he showed us how to do that, yeah, and demonstrated it as a teaching. So the very last thing that he did
was a teaching.
Yeah, because he's altruistic, right? Yeah. I lost track of where we are. Where are we here?
It's the Bodhisattva.
Yeah, let's keep going there.
Can't say that word. Pratyeka Buddhas and Sravakas relinquish their body. What to say of ordinary people?
Okay, so here we have three more categories. We have Bodhisattvas, Pratyeka Buddhas. Oh, we have four categories. Bodhisattvas, Pratyeka Buddhas, Buddhas, and Sravakas. So let's go through those and make sure we understand what those are. Even though we've talked about some of this already, let's review it. So bodhisattvas, what are bodhisattvas?
They're in training to become Buddhas.
Okay, and what characterizes a bodhisattva?
Great compassion and wisdom.
Uh-huh. Compassion for who?
All sentient beings.
Okay. And then Pratyeka Buddhas, which are sometimes called rhinoceros Buddhas.
Solitary realizers.
Or solitary realizers, if you want English. And who are they?
They practice on their own most of the time.
Yeah, so do they belong to the foundation division or to the greater vehicle division?
The foundation.
Foundation division. So they have a motivation of?
Of relieving themselves from the suffering.
Yeah, relieving their own suffering. And they do that, as you said, by practicing alone, basically. Mm-hmm. So they have received teachings in previous lifetimes, presumably accumulated enough that they then go, rhinoceroses supposedly spend time alone. I don't know if that's true, but they say that's true. And then they finish the arhat path alone. So solitary realizers. And then Buddhas, well, we know who Buddhas are. They have the Mahayana path, altruistic motivation. They come from bodhisattvas. They finish the path and become fully enlightened Buddhas. And then the Sravakas, who are they?
Those are the ones who are hearing the teachings.
Yeah, they're called hearers sometimes.
Yeah.
Are there other names for them? And who are they? Where do they fit in this scheme of things?
Another word would be aspirants, right? They have the aspiration to do.
I don't know. Is that a word that you that is used?
I've heard it used.
Okay. So which division are they in? Are they in the foundation division or the greater vehicle division?
They're in the foundation.
Foundation division. Okay. And who are they? Why are they called hearers?
Because they're starting to move on to the path of becoming focused.
Yeah.
To realize end of suffering.
Yeah. So what's the we have three steps. What's the first one?
To hear.
Listening or hearing, yeah. So they've done a really good job of that. And then they've gone through the arhat path and attained arhatship. Now you might ask, what happens to all those arhats once they get there? Does anybody know?
They get reborn to continue the path on a higher level.
How does that happen?
They're ready for it.
They've had enough of that. Okay, so arhatship is a state of not suffering, deep, deep meditation, happiness, in other words. But it's not full enlightenment. And how long do they stay there?
Are those gods?
We don't use the word gods.
Okay, they're different.
A long, 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 long time. Eons and eons, you know, like long time.
Isn't Taril and our... No.
No. And then what happens to take them out of that state of blissful meditation for themselves only?
Hearing the sounds of the Buddha teaching again.
Yeah, the Buddha at a certain point goes and wakes them up.
Mm-hmm. And he says, by the way.
Yeah, alarm clock, ding! And kind of wakes them up. And then where do they go? What do they do?
Well,
what's left?
They're reborn.
But on what path?
On the path of full aspiration for all sentient beings.
Yeah, Mahayana. Mm-hmm. Then they go on the greater vehicle path. Mm-hmm. That's a path that some people take. The Buddha taught for those types of people that have that propensity. But what kind of text is this?
This is Mahayana.
This is Mahayana, right? Mm-hmm. So we won't go into a lot of detail about that because we're on this Mahayana path. And this is faster. Because mm-hmm. Eons and eons and eons and eons is a long time to go that other route. Yeah.
But hey, if it works for you, right?
Yes. However, we have the precious human rebirth and we've discovered the Mahayana path and this text. So we don't want to go that way, we want to go this way.
Yeah. And I think what you just said is so crucial. If it works for you, the whole point of the Mahayana path is not that it just works for you.
For all sentient beings.
It's for all sentient beings. Mm. So that's the big shift. Mm. The huge shift that takes us into the next level.
Aren't bodhisattvas also enlightened beings who choose to come back to, because of their great wisdom and compassion, to help all sentient beings to attain enlightenment? They could remain as a Buddha and do that, but they choose to come back and manifest in whatever way is necessary to help the rest of us.
Yeah, so going into this more deeply, there's different kinds of bodhisattvas. Okay, so there's, how would you say?
11 statements.
I don't want to say ordinary because there's nothing ordinary about a bodhisattva. But there are exalted bodhisattvas and there are non-exalted bodhisattvas. So a sentient being who has taken refuge, gone onto the Dharma path, and then taken the bodhisattva vow is a bodhisattva. I think we could say bodhisattva in training, maybe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Practicing. And that's some or all of us, you know. We're not exalted yet because, as Stephen mentioned, there's levels. So we're not on the levels yet. We're not even on the scale, on that scale. There's actually two scales, but I don't want to go into too much detail here. On the five-step scale, we're on the first step. On the 11-step or 10-step or 13-step, depending on which tradition, we're not there yet. You have to get up to the third level on the first scale to get on the other scale. So most of us are beginners, okay? But again, there's nothing ordinary about it. We go through and we do the practices that we're learning, the perfections and the various things we're learning, and we progress spiritually and we go through the stages. And then at a certain point, you enter the other scale.
And that's where you can manifest in.
But you're still not exalted. You're only exalted when you get to the seventh level. And those are the really, really, really super high beings. And Sakyapandita's Clarifying the Sage's Intent goes into great detail about all this. And I personally find it very fascinating to know, well, now I know the map. It's not just some vague thing about, well, we're going to get enlightened for all sentient beings, but how do you do that? So it's a really clearly defined map, and I personally found it very helpful. And so when you get on to the other scale, you start to have all kinds of spiritual abilities. to actually start really helping people. Where we are, most of us, speak for myself, we try to help, but we kind of fumble our way through it, and sometimes we actually make things worse by trying to help. We don't really have those advanced spiritual skills yet.
Like clairvoyance.
Yeah. So then when you get over here, you get on this other scale, you start having those, and they get tremendously enhanced. Until you work your way all the way up to the top level of exalted bodhisattva, and then depending on which tradition you want to categorize things, at a certain point you make the final step to enlightenment. And then you are omniscient and you have all the qualities of a Buddha, which Sage's Intent goes into in detail. And they're pretty amazing if you haven't studied that. But a Buddha doesn't just stay in that state like the Arhats just sort of stay in that state. The Buddha has compassion. Remember we talked about perfect compassion a long time ago? Compassion for all sentient beings. And then Buddhas respond to the situation. We can't see them, so for them to respond, sometimes they need to, and here they say pretend, I don't like that word pretend, but they demonstrate or manifest certain
forms
or conditions. For example, the historical Shakyamuni Buddha came to earth in India 2,600 years ago and walked around and taught people for 45 years. So that was a manifestation. He took human form so that people could see him and listen and get the benefit of it. But Buddhas are not limited to just human form. They can take any form, animal, spirit, physical objects, whatever the situation requires, they spontaneously manifest their compassion and help if they can. The conditions have to be ripe or right, though. That's why we saw earlier about sometimes Buddhas appear, but the students aren't there, and so the Buddhas don't teach. The students don't have the karma yet to receive the teaching. And the Buddha manifested that, the historical Buddha manifested that, by not teaching for the first 7 weeks after his enlightenment. And it was only when he was requested to teach that he taught. That's why it's really important to request teachings. It's really important to ask and to show the willingness and the signs that you're ready to receive. I remember one time when Geshe-la went out of town, he went somewhere, Seattle or somewhere, for some Dharma event. And he said, ask me to come back. Don't just assume if I go away that I'm going to come back and be your teacher again. You have to demonstrate that you want me. There's this saying, you have to build the pond before the swans will land. So this thing, this idea of requesting and demonstrating that you're ready and you're willing to receive, that's what stimulates the response from the teacher. And that's the way the Buddhas operate. They operate in response to the situation. But the causes and the conditions have to be there for it to happen.
Right, to even know to ask.
Yeah. The Buddha, the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, according to Mahayana, he was already enlightened. He just took birth to show the way for us. To show you, this is how you do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that included showing death. The demonstration of this is how you die. Mm-hmm. He wasn't subject to death. Because you're only subject to death if you have negative karma. Mm-hmm. Well, Buddhists don't have any negative karma. They've cleaned all that. That's part of their arrival. So that's kind of a long description, but there's different kinds of bodhisattvas. And so, for example, Tara is actually the enlightened form of Amitabha Buddha, who manifested in a form of a bodhisattva to act. And bodhisattvas, of course, they can take different forms too. So it's not really downgrading, it's just manifesting in a way that people can interact with. Yeah? But it might be that dog walking down the street. It could be any kind of form. There's no limit to
mosquito
it.
Mosquito on your arm.
Yeah. I kind of rambled there, but...
The homeless person who's delirious on the corner.
Sorry?
The homeless person who's delirious.
Yeah. There's lots of stories of saints that were beggars that, as Dzongtsor Khyentse Rinpoche said, if they showed up at your door, you would not let them in.
But that's a motivation to learn not to be afraid of really someone who's in deep suffering, right?
And not to be judgmental.
And not to be judgmental, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. And to come clairvoyance to see who
is
they
are. Something I've never understood, people being afraid of poor people. I don't get that. I never have.
Okay, so where did we leave off here? Does anybody...
Therefore, having been born...
Sorry, what page are we on?
69.
Okay, and where?
The last,
oh, okay, thank you. Uh-huh.
Do you want me to keep
going? Yeah.
Okay, therefore, having been born, there is no region where one is able to dwell on without perishing, nor is there any place either beneath the earth, on the earth, or above it, where the Lord of Death does not reach. As it was said in the Soko Vinodana,
the removing sorrow.
Though a great sage may possess the five supernatural perceptions and fly far in space, still he is unable to reach any place where there is immortality.
So there's an example of some of these, powers that these bodhisattvas have accumulated on their way up the scale, flying, going forward and back in time, manifesting lots of different bodies, teaching and being understood in different languages simultaneously, all these things. But even if a sage has all these powers and can fly, if they haven't reached enlightenment, they're not yet immortal. And as it was said in this Jataka, which I don't have the English for, and wherever one dwells, there is no place where death does not penetrate, not in the sky, nor in the ocean's depth, nor in between mountains. In brief, one must understand that from the time one has taken birth due to karma and afflictions, one is not beyond the range of certain death. By the way, karma and afflictions are what cause death. That's the cause. Okay, and so B. Who would like to read B?
B. Death is certain because the body is insubstantial. As it was said in the...
That's the Sutra of Aphorisms.
Alas, compounded things are impermanent. They are subject to birth and death. Having been born, they come to destruction. Better, then, is the bliss of peace. That is nirvana. In general, since compounded things arise due to causes and conditions, being nothing more than momentary and perishable, they are not even slightly fit to merit one's trust. Even this hard, firm, and vast world system, with its mountains, continents, and oceans, which is fashioned by the power of the collective karma of all sentient beings, which has been accumulated for a long time, is, in the end, burnt by a single flame of fire in which not even ashes remain. If even such a final time occurs, when space will become empty, then what to say of our own fragile bodies, which are created by small and temporary causes and conditions? They do not go beyond the state of certain destruction, as it was said in...
Letter to a Friend, Nagarjuna.
Since not even ash will remain as all things, the earth, Mount Meru, and the oceans will be burned by the flames of the seven suns. What need to speak of a very frail man?
Okay, so even if the world ends, why would we think that our body isn't going to end? But not only that, let's read on further. Somebody else want to continue?
Sure. If even Vajra bodies of the imperfectly enlightened Buddhas, adorned with marks and signs of perfection, which is fashioned from boundless heaps of merit, are also shown to be impermanent, what of our insubstantial bodies, which are surely composed of deceitful things?
Okay, so what is a Vajra body?
Body of energy.
In this case?
or the body of a Buddha?
It's the body of a Buddha, which is special. Why? Because it's adorned with marks and signs of perfection. How many?
32.
A whole bunch.
Yeah, the different.
In total, 112. There are major and minor marks. For example, if you look at the Sakyapandita statue behind me here, there's a little bump on the top of his head in the statue. That's one of the marks.
I always thought it was the hair.
It's the mark. It's the one of the Buddha marks, which Buddhas have super consciousness that we don't have, and they need somewhere to put it. And that's where it resides anatomically. But it's also not limited to anatomy. It also goes infinitely into space. No one has ever seen the end of it.
What's it called?
Ushnisha.
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 Yeah, it's hard to say. And that's just one example of these marks. There's also chakras on the hands and webbing between the fingers. And there's 112 of these marks. Sakyapandita was one of these beings that was a Buddha. He was Manjushri Buddha, and he manifested as a human being in Tibet as one of the Sakya founders. And the statue indicates that he was enlightened with and he has, normally you see him with a red Pandita hat. I guess people know the statue was bequeathed by Geshe Tashi Namgyal in his will. It was made in Kathmandu, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
Yeah. And it came with a hat, with a Pandita hat, mm-hmm. The red hat, which you can see in that tonka there, the red hat on there. Mm-hmm. But Lama Jampa wanted people to see the Ushnisha.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, take the hat off. So I don't know where the hat is, but it's around somewhere. But that's a sign that you can actually see in the statue. So these 112 marks are the signs of the perfection. And how does a Buddha get those marks? Well, by fashioning boundless heaps of merit.
Mm-hmm.
Remember we talked about the accumulation of merit and the accumulation of wisdom? Well, this is one of the results of the accumulation of merit, the 112 marks. All Buddhas have those. And you can read about those in detail if you want. Even the Buddha's body, when he walked on the earth, he had one too. That's impermanent. Even that's impermanent, is the point. Not only is the world going to end, or the universe, or whatever, but even the Buddha's precious Vajra body. So in this case, Vajra body refers to the Buddha's 112 marks. And then it says, what of our insubstantial bodies, which are surely composed of deceitful things? That's kind of a way to sober you up there about impermanence. And then the Removing Sorrow Sutra said something. Who would like to read that sutra?
Is that the one, if even the Vajra bodies are drawn mm-hmm. by marks and signs of perfection are impermanent, what to say of these bubble-like bodies which are like plantain trees, devoid of essence? Therefore, one should know that one day this insubstantial body, which is held dear by us, will be nothing more than an object that will be burned by fire to become ashes, thrown into water to be eaten by insects and become filth, dried by the sun's heat, infested by worms until it is destroyed, carried by wind and dispersed, rendered rot and grown putrid beneath the ground, or cut into pieces by living beings. As it was said in the letters to a friend, understand that the insubstantial body at the end, becoming ashes, dried, decayed, or impure, will be completely destroyed, putrefied, and subject to dispersion.
Okay, this is something that we all know, but we don't think about very much normally. But if we do daily meditation on death and impermanence, this stuff becomes more in our consciousness, and it actually improves our life. We eliminate the nonsense quite a bit if we do that meditation. Okay, and C, who would like to read the certainty of death?
death is certain because life is not permanent. In general, if one comprehends all compounded phenomena to be impermanent due to momentariness, it is easy to realize that the life of a person is also impermanent. And among all compounded matter, the exhaustion of a person's life is said to be swifter than any other. For example, if someone very skilled in archery were to shoot an arrow in each of the four directions, and if another skilled person were able to catch each arrow before it drops to the ground, that would be considered very swift. Swifter than that are the hungry ghosts who move on the ground. Swifter than that are the hungry ghosts who move in the sky. Swifter than that are the chariots of the sun and the moon. Swifter than that are the gods of great power. And yet, even swifter than that is the exhaustion of a person's life. Therefore, if life is being exhausted at this rate every single moment, what to say of its exhaustion by minutes, days, months, and years? From the time of one's own birth until the present, or from last year until this year, or from yesterday until today, whatever be the length of time that has passed by, so by that much has one's lifespan been decreased. Therefore, since life only decreases and is not increased even slightly, one is not beyond the pale of certain death, as it was said in the Bodhicharyavatara. Since this life continually decreases without standing still, day or night, and from no other source is it augmented, why won't someone such as myself die?
Okay, thank you. So if that's not enough, we're going to be given some examples to illustrate this even more. Would somebody like to read the examples?
Sure. To illustrate this point, people are like a steep mountainous waterfall, like a prisoner condemned to certain death, like a fish which has entered a net, and like animals that have entered the slaughterhouse. Meditate on the example. Like a steep mountainous waterfall. For example, water falling from the top of a cliff flows so quickly that it is as if the latter water were trying to overtake the former falling water. Life also becomes extinguished quickly, as if a latter instance were to overtake a former, and life ends in death, as it was said in...
Yeah, I don't have the English for that.
Sutra. The three worlds are impermanent like autumn clouds. The birth and death of beings is like viewing a dance. The life of beings is like a flash of lightning in the sky, swiftly passing like a mountainous waterfall. But these are only examples of swiftness, while the exhaustion of a person's life is swifter than even these. Like a prisoner condemned to certain death is to be thought of thus, being held by the executioners and led toward the place of execution, the life of a prisoner condemned to certain death draws nearer to death with each step. Likewise, one draws nearer to death with the passage of each minute, day, month, and year. As it was said in...
The Aphoristic Verses.
For example, with every step he takes, a prisoner condemned to certain death draws ever nearer to death. So too is the life of humans. Like a fish which has entered a net refers to the fact that however many of a school of fish might have entered a net, when pulled out of the great water by fishermen, they are all killed one by one until finally there's not a single one remaining. Likewise, one is born in the river of worldly existence, having entered the net of rebirth cast by the fishermen of the afflictions. One reaches the mouth of the Lord of Death and is fit for nothing but death. As it was said in the Bodhicitta, having entered into the net of rebirth, which was cast by the fishermen of afflictions, you have gone into the mouth of the Lord of Death, even now. Do you not know that? Also meditate on, like animals who have entered the slaughterhouse, having been forced to enter a slaughterhouse with no avenues to escape, the animals to be slaughtered see the butcher slaughter each one of them one by one. But those remaining to be killed nevertheless engage in fighting and searching for food without even thinking about what's happening, until finally all, without exception, are killed. Likewise, one has entered the slaughtering pen of birth, and while observing the butcher, the Lord of Death, slaughtering step by step one's beloved friends, kinsmen, and the like, one does not think it will happen so to me. However, one looks to see what things they've left behind and performs the various careless acts of eating, drinking, and sleeping. Yet while engaged thus, one is suddenly slain by the Lord of Death, the butcher, as it was said in the Bodhicitta. Do you not see that the Lord of Death is slaughtering your own kind step by step? But still, you cling to slumber. Like the slaughterer and the water buffalo, the avenues of escape are completely closed, and the Lord of Death is looking on. How can you enjoy food? And how can you like sleeping in this way? To reflect on the meaning of this, one should think, alas, I have not gone beyond being an object of certain death, being powerless to remain long in this world. There's no one in the past who, having been born, did not die. Nor is there anyone living, present, who will not die. Nor any who is being born now who will not die. That being the case, how then shall I not die? If even the teacher, the light of the world, who's free from birth and death due to karma and afflictions, still pretended to pass beyond into nirvana, and if even the assembly of noble ones discarded their karmically ripened bodies as an example for others, what confidence can I have that I, who am totally bound by karma and afflictions, will not perish? There will be a time when even these extremely hard and firm realms, together with their mountains, continents, and oceans, which arise from the inconceivable karma of living beings, will perish so that not even their ashes will remain. Therefore, if even the Vajra bodies adorned with signs and marks of perfection, achieved through the splendor of hundredfold merits, are not permanent, how then would this body of mine, which is insubstantial, a collection, artificial and hollow, be permanent? Hence, this impermanent body that I hold to be permanent, this insubstantial body which I hold to have an essence, will be burned and changed into ashes, cast into water where pieces will be devoured by fish and others, hung on a wall where it will become dried, eaten by worms, so that it becomes empty inside, buried underground where it will rot and become putrid, or cast into a charnel ground where it will be eaten by birds and beasts of prey. Such a condition will come. Alas, a time will surely come when it will be apparent to all that this body of mine is not in the least bit permanent.
Okay. Well, that's pretty graphic. That's the lesson, and now we're going to shift into the reflection part of this. So we've done the listing, contemplation. So who wants to read the contemplation section for us? Thank you. Anybody?
I'll read it. If one reflects in this manner and this awareness of death and impermanence still does not arise, then one should reflect in the following manner. At this time, I am free of bodily disease and mental suffering. Together with my relatives and beloved ones, I am enjoying food, clothing, housing, making provisions for a long life, and engaging in various discussions. However, I never have the thought that death will come. Certainly, there will be a time when all these will be left behind, and the light of this life will suddenly be extinguished. Being permanently separated from them, my relatives will not be able to see me, nor I be able to see or hear them. I shall have to go alone in some unknown, empty, fearful region. Now in this evening part of my life, having seriously considered death, I must practice the pure death dharma, so that it is surely impressed upon my mind. May the preceptors and Triple Gem see to it, that it may happen in this way. Thus think from the depths of one's heart and pray. Also in the intervals between sessions, reflect on the meaning of what was expounded. In the
I don't have the English for that one.
In the sutra, at the time when one is engaged in various pleasant conversations together with one's relatives, associates, and servants, one should think, now I am dwelling together with my relatives and beloved friends, but the time will definitely come when I must permanently part from them. So too, when one is eating food, one should think, now I am eating delicious food, but the time will definitely come when I shall not have any appetite at all for food and drink, and at that time of dying, no benefit will be derived, no matter what food and medicine I take. When putting on fine clothes, one should think, now I am wearing fine clothes, but the time will surely come when I shall be wrapped in dirty, odorous cloth and cast away. When riding a fine horse, one should think, now I ride such a fine horse like this, but the time will surely come when ugly corpse bearers will carry me away. When seated on a fine seat, one should think, now I sit upon such a fine seat as this, but the time will surely come when I shall be cast into a dark hole in the ground. Meditate in such ways until one has the certain realization that death will befall oneself.
Okay, thank you. Well, this is, as I said, this is the meditation suggestion section. If you're going to do the three steps. But also, does this last paragraph remind you of anything that we covered in the past about practicing? All these examples? Do you remember we talked about you don't just practice when you're sitting on the cushion, but you can actually practice 24 hours a day by integrating it into your life? Do you remember when we talked about that? Mm-hmm. What did we say?
That you could be practicing all the time.
Yeah, how?
Well, you see it as an opportunity.
Yeah, but what would be an example?
Well, when you're eating, this is an opportunity to remember that there will come a time when no food will be even palatable and no drink will be able to go down.
Remember we talked about something that's neutral, like walking or turning on a light. You can flip that into practice by saying, may all beings be enlightened, may all beings walk on the path. Well, here are some more examples of how to do that with everyday activities, you know, like eating or putting on clothes or riding your horse. Mm-hmm. So the more you can integrate Dharma into your life, the more practice you get, the more merit you accumulate, the closer you get enlightened, the faster you go. So this is another set of examples about how to do that with this topic that we've been talking about, death. So the suggestion is meditate in such ways until one has the certain realization that death will befall oneself. And also, you don't know when. You can't put off your practice till next week, next month, next life. Because we all know situations where people just, boom, you're gone. So the meditation puts that in deep into your consciousness. Because we all say, yeah, I know I'm going to die. But, you know, really, I'm busy. I've got to go to the store and do my taxes. And you know. But we don't really live like we're going to die. I mean, sometimes we do, but not always. So the more that we take that in, the more the quality of our life improves. And it gets put on a focus, practice. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, even just getting up in the morning.
Yeah.
Is to recognize that I've woken up.
Yeah.
I'm still alive.
Yeah.
How amazing.
What am I going to do with it?
Yeah, the Dalai Lama has a little saying that I actually have on my wall, and every time I get up in the morning, I repeat that, you know, I'm fortunate to have woken up. I'm alive. I have a precious human life, you know.
Yeah.
Start the motivation for the day.
Yeah.
Or when someone dies, you think, well, this will be me.
Yeah.
You know, like all those little things, right?
Yeah. My sister died last week, and so I'm getting all these messages from my relatives about it, and it's right there. There's her photo, but she's not alive anymore, you know. Sometimes people say to me, are you having a good day? I say, yeah, I woke up alive. that's the qualification right there, you know.
You're alive.
Yeah. Okay, well, that was an interesting lesson, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's, I'm going to draw my red line there to remember that that's where we finished. And this is to be continued, of course, next time. But for now, I think we'll stop there and say our dedication prayer. So nam dei tam jesi pani. To bani binanam pamjiti ke gana jibalung dupei sipe sole doa duvarsho jangchub sento rinpoche ma ke panam ke gyuchi Kenan parme paryam gong ne gong tu per parsho jam pa pa urji tar ken padam kundu sang po de yang de jin de de da kung ye jesu da lo che ge wa di da tam che ra tu no tu su je bi ga wa tam che gi nu wa gang la chu tu na pa gi da jin ge we se we di kun sang po chu che ra tu nu Chak sa wa dang chu ching sa pa dang Je su yi rang su shing so wa yi Ye wa chung se da gi chu ya wa Tam che zok pe chang chu chi By this merit may all attain omniscience May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Mudita is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has arisen.
May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer and merit, So do I dedicate all my own virtues, so I might train to be like them.
Through this dedication, praise the Supreme, the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future. I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little merit I may have gained by prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching, be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment.